The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with John Gilroy, managing partner of the Oakmont Group, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, managing partner of the Oakmont Group. Every week, John speaks with public and private sector IT experts about some of the IT trends and challenges facing agencies and industry. Now, your host, John Gilroy.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, we have Derek Weeks, Vice President and DevOps Advocate at Sonatype. Derek, how are you?
Very good, John. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Why, my, a DevOps Advocate. I'm an advocate of eating pizza. So what exactly is a DevOps Advocate?
As a DevOps Advocate, I spend a lot of time in the community connecting thought leaders, practitioners, ideas, and information out there. And I think the more people and ideas and innovation that we connect together, I think the more it benefits the community. So spend a lot of time with people in conversations and connecting folks around the community, and I think we've done some good doing that.
Good. I just I don't use that phrase very often. It doesn't come tripping on your tongue for me. Something like Two Amy's Pizza would come out there easily for me.
Right next door.
So tell us about your company, Sonatype. S-O-N-A-T-Y-P-E, Sonatype.
Yeah, so Sonatype is at a great place in time within the industry. For all the federal agencies out there, or even private businesses that are developing software, those companies want to develop software as quickly as possible to get new features and new capabilities out to their customers. But at the same time, they want to make sure they're developing the highest quality software that's also the most secure. So we're helping organizations do that, not only before they release software into production or to keep it secure while it's in production, but actually baking security in from the very beginning of the development lifecycle, so that as developers are touching their code, they know that it's secure from the beginning and it's secure throughout the development lifecycle. So as cybersecurity interests are growing, certainly DevOps interest is growing in terms of getting code out to market faster, new features out to market faster. We're helping organizations do that to build in higher quality, higher security right from the start.
I hate to sound like inside baseball and toss around these terms, DevOps this and open source that, but there's some people that maybe are stumbling on this show and don't know what these terms mean. But I think there's a big movement in the federal government now for open data and open source, and open source software is a strong movement. And I'm going to let you define open source, and then I'll try to take a stab at DevOps. So you're sitting next to someone on the train. They go, what is open source, Derek? Why don't you tell them what it is?
Yeah, I think there are really two big categories of open source that people have to think about. One is just open source applications. These are applications that may be available for an enterprise that you can pull from the web for use in your organization. Good. And then there is open source in terms of open source components. And for a software developer, these are really like the Lego blocks of building applications within your organization. Developers don't want to code every line of their applications from scratch. They can pull an open source component from the internet in order to help them build their applications faster. And they're actually doing this in massive volume throughout the federal agencies across the board through the government, as well as in private industry.
So it's a good open source. Now, when I think of DevOps, I think of a balance or some kind of like a teeter-totter. You know, one end of the teeter-totter is a software developer. These are crazy people that work 24 hours straight and collapse their desk writing software. And then the other end of the teeter-totter is the guy who is normally in the data center, and it's loud and noisy, and he's connecting things together. And traditionally, there's been this, friction between these two folks. And what's happened is many times the person with all the keys working in the data center now has a data center that's 100 miles away or 500 miles away. And so they have to coordinate together. And so the development people and the operations people kind of working together. And I think this is what DevOps is. And so we're taking open source, which is what the area for the developers and the operators and having them work together in order to achieve this transition to the cloud and transition to safe software. Is it? Good definition.
Yeah, I think the developers themselves, it comes down to breaking down silos within, you know, traditional organizations where you have dev and ops silos.
It's a good idea, silo, that's what it is, yeah.
In there. And I think developers in the DevOps movement and DevOps culture, developers are really focused on what can I build, what new capabilities can I build, and ship those to a customer. And not ship them to operations to take care of, but literally ship them directly to customers and make those available. The operations people and security people are also transforming the way that they think, whereas they were once putting things into production, they're actually now serving the developers to say, how can I help you deliver those needs of the customers faster? How can I break down the silos I'm used to operating in and tell you and work with you on how to bake security in earlier, to bake configurations in earlier that are going to work in production so that you can take the innovative stuff that you're doing and get it out to market or get it to customers as quickly as possible, but making sure that it works, it's of high quality, and of course it's secure when it gets there.
So when I was 17 years old, I graduated from high school, got my first job, and it was in a factory. And it was so hot, I lost 15 pounds the first week. And I had a, guess what? I had a line, and I worked the line.
Yeah.
And it was a terrible job. And that's why I went to college. and so if you take that construct as a factory and a supply line, you can almost apply that to software and talk about a supply chain for software. And you may, instead of having a car on an assembly line that may be a software package, you take different Lego blocks and put it together and construct something. And so there's a supply chain involved in this type of software development, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, for people that are not software developers, they actually don't realize how much software development today is like manufacturing. In fact, when we talk about these Lego blocks or open source components that developers are using, 80 to 90% of an application today is built from these Lego blocks. It's not someone custom coding these applications from scratch, a million lines of code. So with 80 to 90% of these components being pre-built, available for free on the internet, developers can actually be much more efficient and much more innovative in the applications that, they're bringing to market. But I think on, you know, as those things have made us more efficient, we also have to think about not all of those parts are created equally. So if you're Toyota or Apple or Pfizer, you're not just going out and selecting any parts there from any suppliers in the market. You want to supply, you want to ask for the best parts from the best suppliers with the best track records. And so for open source components, if you look at these as Legos, you know, you want to know who are the best suppliers out there? Who can I rely on most? If there's a security vulnerability in one of those Lego pieces, who's going to help me update that and patch it as quickly as possible so that I can get the new version of that Lego into production as quickly as possible? So open source and development have software supply chains of these components where their suppliers, their manufacturers using those, and those parts are ending up in finished goods. And that's really what a software supply chain is.
So instead of a factory line with tires and a chassis and whatnot, this may be libraries of software code that a developer may go in and pull a bit of code from. And the question is, who do you trust? Can you trust that, huh?
That's right. Yeah, you just don't want to pull code of unknown origin, of unknown quality into your organization. If you're going to pull a bit of code in to make yourself more productive, you want to make sure that that's the highest quality piece of code, the latest version, the least buggy, the highest performing, and the most secure code that you're putting into your applications so that you can get the highest quality products to your customers and lead the market or lead the mission that you're going after.
So my listeners are federal IT professionals. They develop programs. They work with external vendors. And so are they resistant to open source? I mean, what are their thoughts as far as trusting random code?
I think if you're not in development, then you may be weary of, hey, what, you know, I thought you were developing things from scratch. What are you bringing into the organization? I think if you're in a development practice, you're already doing this. In fact, you've been doing it for years. A federal agency may bring in anywhere from 100,000 open source components to 500 or maybe even a million open source components a year into their development practice. It's not a ones or twosie kind of thing. In fact, last year globally, we record this in our software supply chain report. In Java development alone, developers consumed 52 billion open source components.
Wow.
In the JavaScript development area, I think they just recorded that they are on track for 100 billion downloads of these components into development organizations. So from the development standpoint, there's very little resistance. I think from an awareness standpoint across the organization, when we talk outside of development, the operations teams, the security teams, those are the teams that perhaps need to increase their awareness of what are we bringing into our organization? Does it meet with our governance standards or security standards?
That's a good transition. Let's take a break. We come back, we'll talk about DevOps and maybe applying security to DevOps and how that applies for my listeners. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're speaking with Derek Weeks, Vice President and DevOps Advocate at Sonatype. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, we have Derek Weeks, Vice President and DevOps Advocate at Sonatype. And we spent the first part of the interview talking in general about the federal government and open source and DevOps. You know, you walk down the street and you want to get an emotional response out of someone, you say Equifax. They get all mad. They pound on the ground and screaming. And they probably should because they did nothing wrong. It's almost like, I remember in the fourth grade, I did nothing wrong here. Me and Derek, we were just standing around and someone else broke the window. And so you get these situations where they did nothing wrong. So tell us about Equifax and how it fits in this whole concept of security and DevOps.
Yeah, unfortunately, I and a lot of other people around this country were impacted by Equifax. And I think, you know, for CIOs or chief information security officers in the federal government or in private industry, I think one of the things that we all ask when we heard about the Equifax breach is, how do I not become the next Equifax? And Equifax was actually unique in terms of the breach that happened there. In most cases, when there's a large breach, we don't understand how it happened. In this particular case, Equifax actually revealed a couple of days after the breach that there was an open source component called Struts 2.
Whoa.
It was a vulnerable version of Struts 2 that had been vulnerable since March of this year within their infrastructure. And the attackers used that to get into Equifax and steal all of the data related to yourself, myself, and others. And I think that the real lesson in this is we talked before about developers are using more open source components. Struts 2 is an open source component. It happened to have a vulnerability in it and that let people into Equifax. But I think the important thing is there were notices out there that this particular Struts 2 component was vulnerable. And those were released on March 7th of this year. And on March 10th, that is the day that Equifax said that the hackers actually broke in through that vulnerable Struts component and began to look through the Equifax network for the data that they would then later steal. I think with organizations out there, what we have to understand is there's a new normal out there. And that new normal is we have to be able to understand what open source components we've used throughout our application infrastructure, where those are, and if there are vulnerabilities. And when those vulnerabilities are announced, we have to be able to react very quickly that in the case of Equifax, within 3 days, we need to know that there's a vulnerability, we need to know where that piece of code is, we need to pull it down, and we need to repair it before the attackers can get in. I worked with other federal organizations that actually understood they were using that vulnerable piece of Struts code. They took down their systems, they repaired those, and they got the repairs in place in a matter of 2 days. And I think that's really the new normal that we have to look at. There's really a business requirement that there's an unsecure piece of code out there, and that business requirement is we need to fix that as quickly as possible. And we have only days to do that. About 10 years ago, the average time to exploit from a vulnerability was 45 days. A couple of years ago, it was 15 days. With Equifax, it was 3 days. So I think we need to be more vigilant about the processes that we have, knowing the code that we have, and how to repair that code when things go wrong.
Well, doing my research for this interview, I went to Twitter. I typed in at Sonatype, Sonatype. Then I went to a real strange Twitter feed called Week's Tweets, at Week's Tweets. And that's where I saw the strut thing. And I figured, well, McPherson strut, guys working on this car. And no, it's got a whole different idea of struts. But so this is a known vulnerability. And that I think the surprise is that more companies weren't hit then, huh? I mean, so a lot of people knew it was a vulnerability and repaired it.
Well, actually, a lot of companies and even federal organizations around the world were hit by struts too back in March. So when this particular vulnerability that hit Equifax, the same vulnerability that hit Equifax was actually responsible for taking down the Canadian Tax Office, for taking down Okinawa Power, for taking down the Japanese Post. I also know that there were other organizations within the federal government that happened to go down during that Struts 2 vulnerability back in March. But those organizations went back up pretty quickly as they identified that they were using that component and had fixed it within their infrastructure. So Equifax was actually not the only one, but it was, of course, the most egregious breach because it impacted so many people across the U.S. And the long tail on that impact is severe. And I think that's why a lot of people, including myself, are upset about it.
So the executive at Equifax left with a golden parachute and a slap in the hand and no harm, no foul. Meanwhile, there's people out there that could be damaged for years based on this.
Absolutely.
Well, we have federal listeners. So they're hearing your story, tale of woe. And, you know, it's interesting from Silicon Valley and Equifax. But so what's it mean to my listeners? So Govey's working over at HHS, over at transportation or something. So what lessons can we learn from this incident?
Yeah, well, I think there are a lot of shining stars across the federal government and people that are really embracing DevOps and embracing secure DevOps practices across their organization, whether they're at the DOD, DHS, IRS, the USPTO, or different organizations that we've worked with. Just yesterday, I was reading a blog by Dr. Suzanne Schwartz over at the FDA. And she was talking about the need for increased security within medical devices.
Is she the MD and MBA? Is that the one? Yeah, I read her article too.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that the thing that was really important about her article was not that, hey, we have medical devices that are out there. There may be vulnerabilities in those. We need to be aware of those. We need to be able to protect the consumers and doctors who rely on those medical devices. But what she said is, we need to be continuously vigilant, and vigilance starts from the moment we start coding, that we need to build security practices in from the beginning of our coding practices. There are other people like John Giardini over at data.gov who just published a couple of weeks ago the GSA's DevSecOps guidance, where he's sharing his knowledge with other organizations across the federal government to understand what are DevSecOps best practices. Those are published on the web. I put them on my Twitter feed, and we can do so afterwards so people can find them easily. But I think if you just Google search the GSA's DevSecOps guidelines, you would be able to find those.
So DevSecOps. Kind of sandwiching in there security into DevOps, huh?
Right, exactly.
And, you know, there's tons of meetups around town here where Govies participate and you can learn. I mean, in Arlington, I think there's every week there's a meetup of different types of variety of DevSecOps and DevOps. And so this is very accessible for many listeners.
Absolutely. And I think that the encouraging thing that we're seeing across the federal government, whether it's people like John Giardini or Leo Garcia over at the DOD, he's one of the CTOs within the DOD, they're not only doing DevOps and implementing DevOps practices and on that journey to do so, but they're sharing their experiences with the community at these meetups. They're sharing, you know, if they've developed open source applications or if they've developed frameworks that they use to get software into production or into missions faster, they're actually sharing that know-how with other agencies. And we're seeing that not only in the U.S. federal government, but across the world. And a recent conference I was running, we had Singapore's digital government agency on, and they had developed an open source application that they were sharing with other agencies within Singapore, but open to anyone in the world to help contribute and improve upon.
I want to talk about just a little thing that's going on in Capitol Hill and then take a little break here. There's something called the Cybersecurity Improvement Act 2017. Is that just for IoT, or what's that all about anyway?
So the Cybersecurity Improvement Act around IoT really focuses on making sure that the software that we're depending on is dependable.
And the IoT could be a medical device. That could be
important. It could be a medical device. It could be a thermostat within our car. It could or within our house. It could be a piece of software within our car that's providing us services or something something on our phone. I think the important thing there is that as more software gets out there in these IoT devices, IoT devices were actually behind the Mirai botnet attack. And even if you don't know anything about that particular botnet attack that was using IoT devices, out there within this attack, what it did was it took down the internet on the East Coast of the United States for almost a day a year ago. And I think that we need to look at how to make those devices more secure so that things like this can't happen at such a massive scale.
My man, let's take a break back, talk more about security, and maybe talk about this concept called all-day DevOps. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio is Derek Weeks, Vice President and DevOps Advocate at Sonatype. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, we have Derek Weeks, Vice President and DevOps Advocate at Sonatype, Sonatype.com. Kind of easy to find right over here in Maryland. All kinds of pictures in their website with their employees having fun and pretty active presence on Twitter as well. A lot of information about security on your Twitter handle, at Weeks tweets, and also at Sonatype, 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 and there's a blog there too. Lots of information. Right before the break, we were kind of talking about security and this IoT Cybersecurity Act and the woman with an MD and a PhD, MD and an MBA talking about devices. You participate in some organization or some group called All Day DevOps that addresses many of these issues. Maybe you could tell listeners what this is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. So All Day DevOps is a community that I co-founded about 18 months ago. And just this past week, we held one of our annual conferences. It attracted 33,000 people from
in just
around,
18 months. Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing how fast the community has grown.
Face to face or virtual?
What was we did this virtual online. Uh-huh. So our aim was to really bring DevOps knowledge to the world. And as part of that, we invited all of these people from around the world to participate and listen to practitioners talk. It wasn't vendors giving sales pitches, but we had 100 practitioners online for 24 hours delivering presentations. And one of the exciting things that we added to the conference this year was a DevOps and government track where we had leaders from the USDA, the FDA, data.gov.
That's going to resonate with this audience. That's going to resonate right here.
Yeah, the Department of Defense. And they were, you know, sharing their experiences and their journey along the way that this isn't a kind of, you know, let's show up tomorrow and do DevOps kind of thing. But it's, you know, people were sharing, you know, their challenges, their obstacles, and also their successes with their DevOps journey and sharing, you know, some of their journeys along the way. The important thing about this for anyone in the community is we set this up as a free conference. It's at alldaydevops.com.
So people in Singapore, people in Silver Spring, São Paulo, anywhere.
Absolutely. Anyone could register to attend this. We wanted to make it accessible to everyone, and we wanted the practitioners out there doing this to share their experiences so that others that are in their own journeys or that want to start their journeys have some reference points out there. And we had some amazing stories that were shared across the federal government, as well as international federal agencies that had participated.
Well, tell me more. I mean, what if someone's listening to this? They're at the Department of Interior, or DOI, as we call it, and they're about to call Suicide Hotline. Can they go? And what are the takeaways from this little event?
Yeah, so I think there were some great journeys. I mentioned Leo Garciga, one of the CTOs over at DOD. He talked about his journey where they were taking manual development processes, manual operations processes, where they could take 8 months to roll out a new piece of code within their organization. Developers could build it in a couple of weeks, but it needed to go through so many authorizations to operate within their organization, approvals through security and other teams. And what they've done and what he talked about and presented this framework of how they put it together, the different open source tools that they used, as well as their development pipeline that he shared, he talked about how they've automated all of these manual processes so that when a developer builds code, they can push it into production immediately with all of the AOs, the ability or the authorization to operate, all of the security tests, all of that baked into the process that rolls this code out into production.
I got to get Garcia in the studio here. Sounds like a bright guy, huh?
Yeah, I can certainly, as an advocate, as a DevOps advocate, I can make an introduction. So he would be a great guy to have on and a great story.
You mentioned salespeople earlier. They like to toss out this phrase, pain points. And I know it's an overused phrase, but what are the pain? So what's the theme you have from the Govies who participated and what are their questions, what are their concerns?
Yeah, I think one of the pain points that came through, and this was from Micah Dienen, one of our presenters who works in the Netherlands at the Dutch tax office. But she said a couple of things during her presentation that really resonated with many people in the community and many people across federal agencies attempting or going through the DevOps journey. And part of that was the reaction in her organization of maybe DevOps isn't the right thing to do here. They had a big breach back in 2013, or I'm sorry, not a big breach, a big downtime period within their operation. They said maybe DevOps isn't the right, this isn't the right place for it. And also, when we talked earlier about development teams, operation teams, security teams, and the silos around them, some of the people in her agency said, I like my walls. I like these walls that we've built up. I like that we have a process for handing it over. And yes, it may be slow, but that's kind of how we work here. And she talked about the challenges of those cultural challenges to change the organization and to change the dynamic and to really focus on the citizens and the constituents that they were serving and how could they deliver better services to those constituents by changing the way that they developed and deployed software in their organizations.
We've always done it that way. Well, Derek, you may not remember this, but back in the day, there used to be antivirus companies that would put a floppy disk with antivirus updates in the mail to you, and they would you'd update with the floppy drive. You may remember that,
I'm not too young to remember that.
And so we've always done it that way. Well, guess what? That's not even within a million years of what the correct way to do it is now. And just because you've always done it that way, look at the incident with Equifax. 2 days, bang, hit.
Yeah, I think, that's the good and the bad of working in the technology industry. And part of, what I think is really the good part is you always have to be learning in the technology industry. There's never a day where you can't say, I'm just going to take a break and stop learning. There's always new innovation. There's always new ways to do things. And I think that's really at the heart of what's pushed technology in the industry forward.
So what does Garcia read? What do you read? What does Garcia read to keep up?
Well, I think a lot of it is, conference opportunities like what we did with All Day DevOps or live conferences in Washington, D.C. every year. There's a conference called DevOps Days. As you mentioned, there are a lot of meetups around the area, whether it's AWS cloud meetups, continuous delivery meetups, or DevOps meetups. We have a lot of great leaders here in the community that are putting these conversations together to allow people to learn from. And then, one of the guys, Nathan Harvey, a local friend of both of ours, works over at Chef Software, leading their community. He hosts a podcast regularly, the Food Fight podcast, where people can listen in and hear what others are doing around the industry, their experiences. Some good friends of mine, Damon Edwards and John Willis, run the DevOps Cafe podcast. Terrific podcast where they invite executives in and practitioners in that are on their DevOps journey. No one's completed the journey, but some are early days and some are a couple of years into it, sharing their experiences. And I think that's where a lot of us learn, is through those conversations with our peers in the industry.
I just had a discussion with the dean over at Georgetown for a rubric for a course I turned in, and we had a list of books, and it went back and forth and back and forth. Now, I like books, but you know, it just, by the time it gets ink on paper and sent out there, it's yesterday's news. I mean, I don't want to say anything, but it's just, it's almost happens too quickly not to keep current with what's happening this week and listen to you and find out these stories. I mean, through online events like this, it's we don't have the luxury of buying a book and reading it, do we?
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of books out there that we could all choose from, but I think as in all genres of books, there are classics. In the DevOps community, the one classic out there is The Phoenix Project. It was written by a guy, Gene Kim.
I try to get him on the air.
And a number of others. I know him, so maybe I can introduce him as well.
I got a friend.
I've got a friend. And Gene actually spoke at our all-day DevOps conference last week as well. But Gene wrote a novel. It's not a technical novel about DevOps, but it was really the journey of an organization. He modeled it after Malcolm Goldrath's book, The Goal, which was released, I believe, in 1984, talking about how manufacturing should work within organizations and can be streamlined and made more efficient. And as we talked about earlier, software development is more like manufacturing these days. And I think there are a lot of lessons that Gene shared in The Phoenix Project.
Let's take a break and maybe look into the future after the break, talk about what's going to happen down the road, and talk more about DevOps native tools as well. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, Derek Weeks, Vice President and DevOps Advocate at Sonatype. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio today, we have Derek Weeks. He's a vice president and DevOps advocate for a company called Sonatype, and put together events to help out my listeners, help out Govies, just trying to figure out open source, securely developing code, how to keep up. He puts together events. There's meetups. There's all kinds of things going on. We talked about all day DevOps, and you can find that on Twitter as well. And I guess you can go to YouTube and see some of these talks as well. Is that right, Derek?
Absolutely. All 100 sessions that we had across the 24-hour day are recorded and available for free on YouTube for anyone that registered for the conference.
So that's real nice and flexible, I'll tell you that much. When I was doing my research for this, I went to different Twitter feeds and articles, and I came across a phrase, DevOps native tools. So what the heck is a DevOps native tool?
There have been a lot of, for the history of technology and software development, there are a lot of different tools around that people have used historically to help build their software, help operate that software once it's in production. But not all those tools are created equally. And in the DevOps native realm, there are just new requirements that need to be baked into the processes that people are implementing. So let me take security tools as one instance. In traditional waterfall development or even some agile development practices, organizations might have 6 weeks to 2 months to 6 months to roll out some new code. And as part of that, they have some security testing services. And those security testing milestones within the release process might take a number of hours or even a number of days to produce a result that says this software is secure or not. In the DevOps realm, people are looking at much higher velocity deployment. And in cases like Amazon.com or Netflix, they may have 10,000 deploys to production a day. So you don't have the opportunity to wait 4 hours or 2 days,
yeah,
right, for a security result to come back. So those kind of traditional security tools don't really fit in the DevOps paradigm. So you need a tool that's built for DevOps, where an evaluation can take a matter of seconds or a matter of minutes. I was working with a chief information security officer at a company in Silicon Valley, and he said, really, for my DevOps native tool requirements, I look at a solution and say, if it's not capable of producing a result or information for my developers in under 5 minutes, then I really can't even entertain it as a solution in the environment. And this was a security guy that really knew that his customer was the developer. and the developer didn't have an hour or 4 hours or 2 days for a response, if he couldn't beat 5 minutes, he didn't even want to take that solution to them. So I think in the DevOps native world, there are just different requirements that we have to look at, some based on speed, some based on quality, some based on security. And there are DevOps native tools out there within the community. In fact, a partner of ours in the industry, ZBL Labs, built a DevOps tools periodic table. So if you want to see some of the DevOps native tools out there, just do a Google search on the DevOps periodic table. And I'm sure that that image will come up on the search.
I was talking to a guy from Ukraine, and he said, you know, there's more software developers outside the United States than inside the United States. Yeah, I guess it makes sense. And so are there areas in the world where this is more accepted? I mean, are there certain areas that this is embraced and held back? And because it was all day, it was all over the world, people from Singapore and India. So are there areas where this is more accepted and less accepted? I mean,
Hey, you know, the exciting part is I think a lot of the thinking really originated in the United States, in the UK, in the Netherlands, Germany, some of the leading countries out there that have adopted new technology or new processes around technology. But it is one of these things where the more open our communication boundaries are internationally, the more people can learn. And as a software developer, if you're a good coder, you can live almost anywhere. In fact, at Sonatype, our development team is 100% distributed. No one sits in the same place, and we have developers from all across Europe to all across North America out to Alaska. In fact, one of our developers picked up and moved to Argentina, didn't even tell anyone on the team, but you know, he was doing work and coding, and doesn't really matter where you live as long as you can produce good code for the organization that you're serving.
I glanced at a article this morning called DevSecOps and Nobody Dies. What does that mean?
Well, I think that was a blog that I wrote yesterday in response to Dr. Suzanne Schwartz at the FDA. And what she was really aiming at was, you know, we need to build security into the medical devices out there that we're relying upon. There are too many stories of, even earlier this year, we wrote about there were software defibrillator programmers that had 8,000 known software vulnerabilities in them. And I think if we're relying on these, if we're dependable or dependent on these medical devices out there, they not only need to be safe, they need to be secure, because if anyone hacks into them, they can really wreak havoc. And as one of my friends, Josh Corman, likes to say, this is where bits and bytes meet flesh and blood, that we don't want to have a catastrophe out there of someone that found out how to hack into defibrillators, insulin pumps, pacemakers that might be connected to the internet, and kill a lot of people. And what Suzanne Schwartz was saying was, we need to be, you know, very vigilant in terms of building security into these devices that we're so reliant upon. And in order to do that, you need to be at the start of development, not at the end of the life cycle or once it's released out into market. Then it's too late. So before people die, we need to be more vigilant about how we're developing software, especially where flesh and blood meets life and limb. Or bits and bytes meet flesh and blood.
We'll have to copyright that or something. That's a good phrase.
I think he probably has.
Yeah. Future time here, crystal ball time. So where do you see DevOps heading in the next 4 or 5 years? And what about your conference? Do you think your conference is going to transition to an actual human being face-to-face conference? Or where's the industry heading and where's your conference heading?
Yeah, I think the a couple of things about the industry overall, and this is really for anyone that's developing software, has applications that are serving citizens, serving missions out there, or serving consumers, is that there's so much technology innovation happening at such a rapid pace, and a lot of that is enabled by open source that's available to these organizations. If your industry or your services or your mission haven't been disrupted yet, it's going to be disrupted. I think that's an inevitability. Also, if your organization hasn't yet been breached, it likely has, But if it hasn't been breached, you'll likely be breached in the next 5 years. And I think we can't be, you know, we can't have the fatigue breach that people might experience where I hear a new cyber breach every day. I think we need to be more vigilant about the software that we're developing, the applications that we're putting out there, and those that, we're serving with those. In terms of the conference, I really think that the door's open to the future. You know, in our first year, we reached 13,000 people. The second year, just last week, we reached 33,000 people around the world. And I think the virtual conference and the being that the conference is also free enables us to reach a lot of people with a lot of knowledge from practitioners and their peers and the leaders out there within their own organizations, both in the federal government, a track that will continue in next year's conference, but across industry. And I think sharing that knowledge is the most important thing. And I think the medium is terrific because we can reach anyone at any time. And because it's all available live on YouTube for recording afterward, anyone can absorb it on their morning commute, at their office, or at home sitting in bed. So
I think that's especially if you work for the federal government and there's a particular area that you're interested in. You may not be interested in certain retail applications or banking applications, but you may be interested in what Garcia has to say about doing a project you're working on now.
Yeah, one of the things that I realized was when I was going to these DevOps conferences, the live ones, I would meet people like Leo Garcia, and I would say, wow, oh my gosh, you have an amazing story. But when we look at his organization or the Department of Defense overall, he might be one of thousands of people that were able to attend that conference that couldn't come from the DOD, that couldn't afford the travel, that couldn't afford the conference fee. So we made this available to everyone. We said, you know, our benchmark is free because that means DevOps knowledge accessible to everyone in the federal government and outside. And I think that's really what we're committed to delivering.
Great. I'm a big fan of free, but we're running out of time here. You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'd like to thank my guest, Derek Weeks, Vice President and DevOps Advocate at Sonatype. Thanks, Derek.
Thank you, John.
You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, Managing Partner at the Oakmont Group. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Federal Tech Talk.